I thought we'd resume because we do have sort of a special occasion in Sedona today that might bear considering the questions we asked before. We got that the relics did, let's redo it. The relics that are spoken of are genuine, is it? It's worthwhile for us to visit them, is it? Wow, there's a karmic merit in so doing, is it? Huh. There is an energy that radiates from them, resist, which is over 800, 900, 950, 960. Wow. All right, we get that this is a rather unique occasion. These relics which are present in Sedona will only be visitable for the rest of the day. I thought what we might do is break early. I'll tell you how to get there. And those of you who wish to, we might visit the relics, because the alternative is to spend 14 hours flying over to Asia. Which I have done. I'll tell you, that from here to Korea is a long way. I miss going this year. All right, so we have these, it says that they are genuine, that it is of karmic merit to merely visit them, that they do create a beneficence of their own, and of course the willingness to acknowledge, what would we say, the value of divinity and whatever its expression is a karmic merit that comes from within your own spiritual self. So we thought we might break early and go visit the relics. They're on display until 5 o'clock. Then at 5 o'clock, the Buddhist community here, which is represented by our wonderful videographer, and there's a strong Buddhist community here. Anyway, they have somehow gotten these assembled relics here. Anything Calvary's that high is worth a visit. So I thought we might break early. I'll tell you where it is. You go out West Sedona. See, we're at the Y here. You go back to the Y, you turn right, you go through up the hill through Sedona, and at the west end of town, as though you were going to Cottonwood, the last stop in Golight, there's construction there, you turn right. And you go into what's called Sedona Cultural Center. And once you made the right into Sedona Cultural Center, that's right across from Upper Red Rock Loop Road. That's right across from the high school. You go in a way, and there's a big sandwich board. It tells you you turn to the left. But I thought it might be fun. We just go visit these relics. Using kinesiology, we can calibrate the merit, the worthwhileness, the impact it would have on our own spiritual growth, the worthwhileness of it, and we'll take a democratic vote. We'll go. There you go. There's the true democracy for you. My votes are all and yours are none. Okay. What'd you say? Oh, yes. It's a rare opportunity, and of course it's aligned with our purpose. Our purpose is to evolve spiritually, and when we get on the other side, we'll say to them, and we did visit your relics. Yeah, again, he's at the door. He said, did you visit my relics when you had an opportunity? No. Never turned down a relic. I've never visited a relic before, and I never gave it serious consideration until we calibrated it. And the integrity of this, and therefore the intent is integrity. All right. So the integrity. See, the integrity is in the intention. What is the intention? To acknowledge divinity in whatever its representative form. We did it this morning using women as an example. We didn't mean to use it as women vis-a-vis men, you see. The ego tends to see that as a separation. We were just naming mankind by that name. mankind is also by the name of man. It's woman, woman, woman. Man is part of woman, right? Or is woman an addition on the man? They stuck a woo in front of men. Got women. All right, so anyway, that's all political baloney. Well, to see the divinity within all that exists. Well, the divinity, the existence of divinity within certain aspects of life or certain gurus, pieces of consciousness that speak to you, etc. It's just that they're more recognizable, you see? That same divinity is within all that exists. It is not possible for anything to exist unless it comes out of creation. All that comes out of creation then has within it the essence of divinity, or it could not be for anything to be. Huh? So, in deciding to go over and visit the relic, then we take advantage of a rare opportunity. We give thanks to the Buddhist community for making it available to us, and we give recognition to the value of our own research methods to discern the true from the false. I'm sure there's all kinds of false relics all over the world. And if you go to South America, many of these things are for sale, you know. Pre-Columbian stuff is for sale everywhere on every street corner. As soon as you get off the airplane, pre-Columbian art. And it makes your arm go weak. That's the only difference. Pre-Columbian art that makes your arm go strong costs a lot more than that which makes you go weak, I'll tell you. All right, so we've got some interesting questions. I want to finish them. So if their exhibit is until 5, if we leave here at 4, that would give us plenty of time, and things are pretty much cleaned up. I just thought it'd be fun to move us as a group, you know, to a different context and acknowledge the Buddhist community here, which in itself is a good thing to do. Huh? We saw that Buddhism had declined the least of all the world's religions, very interestingly, because it stuck to its own spirituality rather than getting involved in local politics. What happened to most religions, I think, is that they got invaded by the local politics to get the church to align itself with this regime versus the House of Habsburg versus the House of something or other, of course, is what caused it a lot of its believability. So I think we've answered most of the questions that we had on top of the list. I want to make sure. We're often asked about Joel Goldsmith, and we've done him many times. You see, there's many spiritual teachers that are in the high 400s. Joel Goldsmith is in the high 400s, 490, 495. 500, Joel Goldsmith's writings are over 495. His writings are over 500. His writings are about 495 resist. Okay. So he's taking you as far as the intellect can take you in the understanding of truth. The teachers in the high 400s are often very excellent because they have mastered the knowledge. And of course, spiritual searchers are very often in the 400s, and the erudition that comes in the high 400s is what springs you into the 500s. How do you get out of the 400s? Because you learn within the 400s, the world of the intellect, that the intellect is not going to give you the answer. So the greatest fruit that the intellect can give you is, I ain't what you're looking for. Whoa. Because all of society thinks all you got to do is read another book and take another course and you'll get there. Nisargadatta Maharaj's level of consciousness on the earth was over 700. The book I Am That, I think, is 700. Other books really are in the high 400s. Somebody asked me what love is. Well, okay. As commonly understood, love is an emotion, and this emotion goes from here to there. Love is something you give. Love is something you get. Consequently, love is something you can lose. Therefore, love is volitional, it's conditional. There's a famous cowboy song, something like, I just don't love you anymore. Sorry, babe, but just ain't got that old feeling for you the way I used to. Love is also something that's deserved. You have to earn love, you have to pay for love. It's like a commodity, a very pleasant one and highly regarded. But it's losable. It goes from here to there, and therefore it's subject to dissolution and vulnerable to attack. It's something that people fear the loss of, etc. So what is love actually? Well, as those of you who've gone into really high spaces know that love, the love they're talking about is really about up here. Love is a way of being. It's a way of being with the world. The condition of lovingness prevails as a permanency because it's what you are, it's what you have become. The willingness to be friendly in Walmart is because you're a loving being. It's coming from your lovingness. It doesn't depend on whether this lady with her basket smiles you or appreciates it. It's just who you are, and it's who you are in all times, places, and conditions. It doesn't change. It's not given, it's not lost, it's not taken away, it's not something you earn. It's what you've become. Similar to generosity. Generosity is a way of being in the world. It doesn't have to do with money. Generosity has to do with the willingness to be open and share what you are with life for what? For the good of life itself, only because of that's what you are. It's because that's where you've become. You automatically appreciate life and all its expressions. You know what I mean? You drive along a country road. There's a place I go to, the girls' ranch, three mornings a week, where I'm chief of staff. Got 55 girls there in all conditions of disarray, I'll tell you. Anyway, on the way there, there's a bunch of cows, you know, a bunch of cattle there. And you can't help but stop and love them. You know, the cows look at you and like this. I mean, I say, this morning I'm not going to stop with the cows. It's 8 o'clock already. But then the cow's staying there, and she looks at me like that. And you just have to be with the cow because she's life expressing itself in that beautiful way that a cow is. You know, a cow is just a beautiful creature being what it is, you know what I'm saying? And there's the little calves there being what they are. And, of course, you know they're going to get eaten someday. You can even say, I'm going to love eating you sometime, baby, you know? Why is the cow there? Well, if you didn't eat meat, there wouldn't be any cows. You realize that? If everybody gives up eating meat, cows will disappear. Who's going to raise them? Who's going to feed them? Who's going to go to all that work? For what? Right. The eating of cows, then, means that millions of cows come into experiencing life. When they get put to sleep, they instantly disappear on the other side, and they come back as another cow again. It's all the same cow. Let's see if that's true. Generically speaking, it's all the same cow. It's all the same cow. Why do we say that? Because the consciousness of, we did it on our orange kitty. All orange kitties are the same orange kitty. Yes. We said that evolution, as it appears in physicality, is the reflection of that which has occurred on the level of consciousness. It's on the level of consciousness that form evolves into the forms that we see as life on Earth, you know? The form can then be optionally energized by energies on the other side, you might say, we'll say for convenience of speech, on the other side, can opt to be the life energy within that form. that form has a central, you remember in power versus force, we talked about attractor fields. In the nonlinear domain of what appears as chaos, multiple orange kitties all over the planet, there is a central attractor field of orange kittiness. We could even draw it if we had a computer. There's an attractor field. Nature draws attractor fields for you all the time. All you have to do is fly in a plane and look at the formation of the earth below you and the vegetation. As you watch, there's a beautiful series of videos on right now, or TVs on now, called The Deep Blue. What is it, Deep Blue? Yeah. Underwater, a magnificent series on the History Channel, I think it is, or Discovery Channel. Anyway, incredible beauty, the incredible beauty at the depth of the sea, stunning creatures. So stunningly beautiful, you just suck in your breath, you go, that's existing 5,000 feet down in the dark. Ooh, gorgeous, radiance, beautiful. But you see the schools of fish wheeling as though they're one, like this. You see the whole tens of thousands of fish all in a design like this. You see the same thing with the birds taking off. They all go like this. Well, the presumption of the ego, which believes in causality, is that this bird is flying like a squadron of fighters, this many feet from this one. It thinks that these birds are following this bird's so actually what's happening, these birds are not following each other at all. These birds are being controlled by an attractor field in the invisible domain. Each bird is uniquely controlled by the same attractor field. And that's why they line up. They're not following each other at all. So when you see the birds wheeling like that, that's the demonstration of the attractor field, which is in the invisible domain, becoming manifest in a flock of birds in flight. That's stunningly obvious in this series, The Deep Blue. You see 5 million minnows all turning as one in the shine of light as they swing. They swing like one being, and thousands of bodies simultaneously. That's the attractor field. The animal gods of the Native Americans, the many gods of the Hindu pantheon, all represent to me symbolic, those are the attractor fields. In other words, there is central to all orange kittiness the essence of that which makes orange kittiness, and it radiates out what looks to perception as individual separate orange kitties, but there's only one orange kittiness radiating out. You understand what I'm saying? So the essence of each genus and species then exists on the invisible domain and actualizes within the physical. What I said is true. Resist. There is one orange kitty. Resist. There is one orange kitty. The reason I know this is I've had a whole series of orange kitties, and it's always the same kitty. I mean, an orange kitty's nature is the same. Do you ever notice that? Doberman pinschers, they're all the same, you know. So we love each species and genus because it represents in physicality certain characteristics that we've come to love and appreciate.
That goes for the animal kingdom, but does that go with the human kingdom the same?
Oh, you would ask such a question, wouldn't you? Oh my goodness, I don't know. Turn out the lights. This is a valid question, Resist. It's an answerable question, Resist. It's not an answerable question. I think because of individual karma. In the condition of the human, we have individual karma, Resist. Yeah. So we don't represent a group, the manifestation of, Otherwise, there would be like one human being, and we would all radiate out the sameness, the sameness. But what we radiate mainly is difference, right? There's a sameness to our essence, but a difference. Could be that different races maybe represent, maybe perhaps different races represent sort of a coalition of energies resist. No, they don't either. So humanness is an individual karma resist.
Did we earn that?
Orange kittiness is a group karma resist. Well, there's certain spiritual teachings that animals share a group karma, whereas mankind has individual karmas. So the orange kitties then have a group orange kittiness karma. They have a pretty good karma. We have permission to ask that. Humans have the capacity to reincarnate in subhuman forms, resist. No, I've asked that before. We always get no. So you don't have to worry about coming back as a frog. Only a frog gets to come back as a frog. All right. What was the reason we got onto this anyway? This asks the purpose of enlightenment. Well, is the highest level of enlightenment the desire to help others become enlightened? You might say so if that, but that again is a program that is projected on the condition. The condition only is what it is. It is what it is to the world because it is that. It's similar to the question about lovingness. You see, you're not loving in order to anything. You understand what I'm saying? You're not. Once a person becomes loving, there is no purpose to that lovingness. It's just what they are. They become that. So you're not, that lovingness doesn't like present itself in Walmarts in order to make other shoppers happy or for any other reason. It's just who you are. And who you are turns some people on and probably makes other people hate you. Lots of people hate love. There were countries in the world in which it was illegal, you know. Cambodia was one of them. Remember Pol Pot? You put to death if you display affection and lovingness in public. It's suitable for execution. So, a Japanese warrior in Nanking who showed lovingness towards his captive, I'm sure may have been gotten himself bayoneted on the spot for insubordination. Nikki.
Is there a correlation between intelligence and consciousness?
I never asked that before. You mean like IQ?
IQ. Intelligence.
Yeah, there is some correlation, meaningful correlation between IQ and consciousness resist. No. You can be have an IQ and be very stupid. You can be very stupid and be very beneficial to the world, you know? So, no, apparently not. It's just some people are built more muscular. Somebody came up today and he was the perfect mesomorph. You know what I mean? He had like muscles and bone. And he could probably lift 100 pounds like, you know? I was born an ectomorph, you know? Lifting anything over 50 pounds has always been a struggle my whole life. And I always tell people are born somatotypes, endomorph, this is off the subject, endomorph, mesomorph, and ectomorph. An endomorph tends to be chunky, tends to be very family-oriented, got to have family around you, values familyness, homeness, domesticity, and dieting probably isn't going to do any good at all. If you look at a candy bar, you gain a half a pound. So they have a wonderful digestive tract. The mesomorph tends to be more muscular and capable of sports. And the mesomorph, as they get older, if they sit in front of the TV and drink beer, they're going to put it on. But if the mesomorph cuts down their diet and exercises, they will lose weight. So the mesomorph can either gain or lose weight. The endomorph is going to stay on diet pills, but they aren't going to really take much in the way off. It's not going to change their lifestyle anyway. The ectomorph is skinny and neurotic, and who's that actor that typifies the Woody Allen typifies the ectomorph? Yeah, thin and wiry and somewhat nervous and neurotic and prone to nervous breakdowns. Never going to gain weight, and eating too much just makes him throw up. He doesn't gain weight. So we sort of accept our fate, you might say. If you're an endomorph, quit struggling with it. Become the happy, jolly, fat person that everybody loves. If you're a mesomorph, be sure and diet and exercise if you gain weight. And if you're an ectomorph, you're too neurotic to worry about it anyway, so. Now, you can't rate anything. You can't rate anything up and down the scale. You can only know where it is. Many of the world's best spiritual teachers are in the high 400s. They are more capable of expressing, verbalizing, making comprehensible and understandable the word spiritual truth than people in the 800s. Let's say. Most people in the 800s are totally unintelligible. Most of them stay home. You never see them in public. First of all, there's nothing to say. That's quite a roadblock to begin with. Take you 20, 30 years to figure what you're going to say about all this. There's nothing to say about it. Most spiritual teachers of a very advanced enlightenment are not necessarily good teachers, any more than Paderewski was a great piano teacher. Nijinsky was probably a very lousy ballet teacher. You know what I'm saying? The fact that you're a great musician doesn't make you a great teacher. The best teachers of good musicians are themselves not genius musicians. Otherwise, they'd be on the road. In childhood, the great artistic merit was greatly appreciated by the family. We traveled endless miles to see Nijinsky or any of the great performers of the day. And my grandfather and my mother's side knew a lot of them personally. And many of them were great virtuosos, but as teachers, forget it. Make one mistake, get out of here, I can't stand it, you stupid idiot. Lousy teachers. All right. So a great teacher, very often the high 400s, these are often the most erudite teachers. They're the most erudite teachers. They can compare the world's literature, cite all the references that reinforce and confirm each other. So they are great clarifiers of spiritual truth. So you can't say that a teacher at 540 is better than a teacher at 480. They're different. They're teaching different things. The higher one goes up the scale, the more it is that the presence of that which you are itself has the transformative effect, rather than verbatim, the wording. Yeah? The wording. So there are some beings in whose presence one feels an elevation of consciousness, but they may not write at all. They don't have any linguistic verbal fluency. They're not great writers. And there's great writers who have the data down pat. They're interesting, but you don't exactly go into a state of samadhi in their presence. See? So one is not better than the other. They serve different purposes. Very often, when you go with the way of the heart, which we'll talk more about at a later date, you can bypass and shoot all the way up, because love bypasses the intellect altogether. You understand? Love takes you to 500, and it's beyond reason. It's beyond reason. Somebody says, why do you love that person, thing? You can't give any reason why. You can't give any reason. Certain music, you instantly transcend. Who's that newest tape we have right now, CD? No, let me just calibrate what he's in. The music I'm thinking of now calibrates over 500, 520, 530, 540, 550, 560, 570. My God, he's way up there. What's his name? The music I'm thinking of calibrates at 560. Andrea.
Bocelli.
Andre Bocelli, right? Correct? All right. So you see what the space you go into as you listen to that music, if the way of the pathway of the heart is open in you, tends to bring tears. That's why it's not good to drive to. It's bad music to drive to because you lose all interest in going anywhere for anything about anything. I mean, everything is total and complete right now. Where is there to go for what? You know what I mean? That's his name. Five, what was he?
5, 6, 7.
Way up there, okay. So artistic, that which is great beauty, the great cathedrals of the world, you know, calibrate around 700, Chartres. You go into a cathedral like Chartres and you can't stop crying. It's just overwhelming. And some of the great cathedrals I've been in, they just overwhelm you. All thought stops. The joy of beauty comes up and you can't function in that state. I've noticed there's no graffiti in the great cathedrals of the world. Isn't that interesting? Because that which hates beauty is the source of graffiti. Graffiti usually desecrates that which is, let's see, what does it desecrate? It usually desecrates that which is below 200 resist. Desecrates that which is about 190 resist. Let's see, graffiti is usually used to desecrate that which is above 190, 192, 195. Okay, so anything calibrates around 195 tends to pull forth graffiti to face it, huh? At 500, even the weirdest person doesn't have what it takes. So great beauty then overwhelms people, sets them back into the reality of the self, out of which such thinkingness does not arise. With the exception of extreme madness. I see you being right now, okay. We have permission to ask about the Pieta resist. Pieta calibrates over 550, 580, 590. Pieta calibrates at 590. That which desecrated the Pieta, we have permission to calibrate it, resist. Its level was over 60. Its level was over 40, 45. That which desecrated the Pieta, you remember when the Pieta was attacked? The entity was 40, it says 45. Oh boy, still walking in 2 feet though. 45. Infuriated probably by the perfection. What did we say the Pieta calibrated at? I forget. Anyway, way up there. So that which is incredible beauty has a tendency to throw you back into the self. To walk into the world's great cathedrals that have been there for 1,000 years, the incredible music, the incense, the beauty shining forth through the stained glass windows, even if it's not your religion, the reverence, the collective reverence, the worship of God expressing itself as such incredible beauty, has an uplifting experience. One then ascribes that experience to the out there-ness of the cathedral. No, the cathedral lifts you to the experience of that which is present at all times within yourself, but you only allow yourself to experience under these conditions. That which you're experiencing is the presence of the divine within. Incredible beauty then unleashes the dam in which that which is love, that which is sacred, shines forth. And that radiance is what makes you feel like crying. You know, incredible beauty brings a lump in your throat. Incredible beauty as it rises makes the hair in the back of your head stand up. And then as it gets even higher, you can't stop crying. Huh? Is that so? Those of you who have gone into incredibly beautiful spaces know that you can't stop crying at a certain level. At a certain level, you can't even witness anything that has to do with love. It just breaks you up. Little puppy walking down the street, you know, you break out in tears. I mean, it's adorableness, it's lovableness, and you can see what it means to the owner. You know, the whole space of all that lovingness is just too much. It just knocks you out. So there's a difficult time there, a difficult time of weeping and crying over the presence of divinity as beauty and love. Now, we have to be sure and stop at a certain time. What time did we say we were going to stop so we can get to the relics? Okay. We've got a little bit more time, and then I'll allow you time to get yourself together. I don't know if we can do it as one frog and the other, but as I say, I'll tell you again once more how to do it. When you come out of Creative Life Center, you're going to turn right. That's going to take you to the Y. The Y, you make a right. You cross over the bridge by Tlacopaki. You come up to a stop-and-go light, and you make a left that goes to West Sedona. You go past all the stores and all the stop-and-go lights, and the last stop-and-go light is Upper Red Rock Loop Road, Upper Red Rock Loop Road. And you make a right. It's like 5 or 10 minutes, you know, it's not very long from here. Short trip. And what we could do is reconvene there, and we can perhaps ask some more questions. We may have a chance to meet the members of the Buddhist community. They're going to be assembling at 5 o'clock for some kind of a meditation. Now, what other do we have any questions that I haven't answered? I want to make sure we've answered all the possible questions that people have brought up. I may have skipped some. It says, is consciousness a byproduct of spirit entering dense matter? No. No, it is not. Consciousness arises prior to matter. Genesis is pretty correct, according to our own research, that out of what appeared as chaos to perception, which is really non-form, arose light as consciousness. The power of consciousness is such that it can, initiate life when it touches matter. And that matter then evolves from below up. So creation is from above down, and then we see the evolution of life forms from the bottom up, from the ooze to usins. Then we can look down on the worm. We'll get somebody to look down on. What is the difference between mind and consciousness? Consciousness is the field which supports the phenomenon called mind. Consciousness itself is without form. Without form. Just before you think a thought, what you're experiencing is awareness, which is radiating out of, it's an aspect of consciousness. If you want to, you can watch and see. Right before every thought, you have an opportunity. That opportunity presents itself continuously. It lasts about 1/10,000th of a second. You gotta be quick, eh? That space is 1/10,000th of a second approximately resisted. It's more than that resisted. No, it's not more than that, darn it. It's always been like 1/10,000th of a second. When we say that, it sounds very, very minimal, and who the heck's gonna make it through the crack in 1/10,000th of a second. That's an only temporal physical time. That doesn't sound like much. But in that space of that 1/10,000th of a second, you're looking at eternity, which is outside of time. So you have a window open to that which is beyond time, the infinite. 1/10,000 of a second. What does that mean? What does that mean? It means then you become aware of your thoughts as sort of a thingness thing. It's sort of like your thought is a thing, see? Right prior to this thing occupying the space of your attention is a space. If there wasn't an empty space, the thought would have no place to present itself. Do you know what I'm saying? Without a blank screen, there's nothing for a thought to project itself upon. With a little self-reflection, the best place to become enlightened is driving, riding in a taxi cab, any place. waiting in the line at the supermarket. One's thoughts go by nonchalantly, and suddenly one sees one instant right before the thought, that's who you are. And you pull back into that no-thinkingness prior to thought. It's there all the time. It's there all the time. So it's said that the entryway into enlightenment is in the instant of now. That now is always present. It only takes a curiosity, really. You don't have to fast and join a monastery or a nunnery, beat drums and gongs and chant all day. You don't have to beat yourself, deprive yourself. Every possible instant of now is forever present. Outside of time, forever is this moment. So you really, in a way, have forever to notice this. Out of sheer curiosity, forget about enlightenment, forget about God, all that. Just out of sheer curiosity, watch and see that each thought arises in an empty space. Be with the empty space, and as the next thought arises, the empty space is there again. The empty space presents itself continuously. And then one sees, I'm the space and not the thought. It's simple. Any more questions? I want to make sure they're all answered, and then maybe we'll take off for the relics, which will be a fun thing to do. Yes? What did you say? Oh, yes, indeed. Right. Oh, yeah. I hope somebody remembers what we were. We were 433, all right, I think. Okay. We have permission to calibrate the energy of the group, so it's over 433. 434, 435, 436, 437, 438, 439, 440. Wow, 441. Holy cats. Went up 7 points, 7 or 8 points. As a group. As we said, the average consciousness advances 5 points in a lifetime. We went up 7 points in a matter of hours, you know. So what does that mean? It just means there's a willingness to hold belief in suspension and allow a different energy to recontextualize what you already know. I probably didn't say anything you haven't heard before today, a few unique things perhaps, but the way in which that is held, the readiness of the field. So to become enlightened is to see that one is the field and not the content of the field. That's the only difference. You're the field in which the thought presents itself, and you'll catch it 1/10,000 of a second. You don't think that's possible? Yep, because if you're watching for it, that tends to potentiate its appearance. The minute you get curious about what is there prior to thought, prior to mind, the minute you get curious about it, that fires off the quantum potential for that to present itself as a reality. You understand what I'm saying? To merely be interested, curious about it, to hold that in mind tends to increase the potentiality, the likelihood of it manifesting as its experiential reality. Yes?
I don't know how to ask this question. You said that since reality and the context we are seeing, the context of what we are seeing, the reality is what it is. It is perfect. Nothing is
If everything is perfect, what's the point of perfecting anything? Because it is perfect already. Is that the essence? Yes? Everything is perfect as it is. What does that mean? Nothing can be other than the perfection of that which it is. That has to do with the a thing that's very hard to explain. The radical identity of self, of that which it is with that which it is, in which there is no absence of information that has to be projected onto it by the observer. What you're asking is easy to see, difficult to answer in a verbal form. Before me lies a piece of plastic. It's absolutely perfect. It's perfectly exactly that which it is. The perfection is in that it fulfills its karmic destiny at all times, absolutely. It has no destiny to be a camel. It would be an imperfect camel. But it is not an imperfect piece of plastic. It would be imperfect in the eye of the groundskeeper who feels it should be swept away. Huh? But that's trying to impose form on what is. What it is the absolute perfect expression of all that it takes throughout the evolution of all of time, through the invention of plastic, through all of us being here, through the gravity, through the barometric pressure, for this building to be here, for Sedona to be founded, etc. It took all of that for this divine piece of plastic to be where it is. You remember that movie? It was one of the funniest movies I ever saw, which a Coke bottle falls from a plane into. What was the name of that movie? Huh? What was the name of that? The Gods Must Be Crazy, right. The Gods Must Be Crazy is one of the, a wonderful movie for spiritual seekers, you know, see? Because you see how we project onto a thing what we think it is, which has nothing to do with what it is, you know? Its value became, when two people wanted the one Coke bottle, that was the beginning of the breakdown of their society. One person had a Coke bottle and only one. Uh-oh, now everybody else wanted the Coke bottle. And the fight started. And of course, that's a very comical. So perfection is then what you see it as. There are different levels of perfection because they're really all a definition, you see? In the absolute, the word perfection would be meaningless. Just like the word beauty is meaningless when you stand there looking at a sunset. Incredible. All words you could use would be irrelevant. Everything is perfectly what it is at every moment because there is no other possibility. Any other possibility is an intellectual positionality with no, that does not reflect any reality. Nothing can be anything except that which it is. To be that which it is, it already has to be perfectly that which it is, or it couldn't exist at all. For the evolution of consciousness to take the forms that it takes. So as consciousness evolves, it takes these forms. Here's the Middle East right here. Here's a Neanderthal man. It gets to here from there. So you can't make it wrong for being in the process of getting here. It isn't here yet. That which was what it was, as evolution became more and more conscious. Homo Spiritus is just born. 5 minutes ago. Homo Spiritus is just barely the latest evolutionary tree of mankind. It doesn't value the physical and the material anymore. It doesn't value wealth. It doesn't value, the ego comes out of the evolution of animal consciousness and survival. Homo Spiritus doesn't even value that anymore. You can give me $10 million to do something non-integrous, and it would sound like a joke, wouldn't it? You're going to sell your soul for what? Don't be ridiculous. To someone who's not to that level, it would be a major temptation, you understand? So we've become a different kind of an entity. If I say to you, visiting a relic will have its spiritual advantage, we all say, hey, let's go. If it does not have a spiritual advantage, we wouldn't leave, would we? So we are brought together by spiritual intention, that which sets our karma. So as a group, we share a common karma. People dedicated to spiritual intention, that is what becomes paramount, surmounts other objectives, makes people travel long distances, etc. So the same drive that brings us here today would give us the spiritual curiosity. What is it like to visit a genuine ancient spiritual relic? I don't know. I've never visited one. So spiritual curiosity then is charged up by our spiritual commitment. Huh? Will we all see God as we visit the relic? I don't know. Will we all get a great buzz? No. I think we'll all get a great satisfaction that somehow as a group, we acknowledge that the presence of God as it radiates forth into this world at a consciousness level of over 900, which is a very rare opportunity. So out of reverence for God, we say thanks for the opportunity and avail ourselves of probably once in a lifetime experience. How many here before have had a chance to visit a great relic? A couple. All right, so we'll quit here for today. I've tried to answer all the questions I could. It's been my great pleasure. It's been my blessing.